Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the computer software Video Poker for Winners, and in 2004, he was inducted into the Video Poker Hall of Fame. Richard Munchkin has been a professional Advantage player for over 30 years and is in the Blackjack Hall of Fame. His book, Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers, is a testament to the many ways you can succeed at gambling. The goal of the show is that you'll be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good evening. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest tonight is Tyson Stribe, one of the five authors of the new poker book, Flop Turn River, which is the latest offering from Huntington Press in the Kill Phil series. We'll be talking to Tyson in a minute. In Atlantic City, there's been this long-running court case about baccarat players at the Golden Nugget. The Golden Nugget was using pre-shuffled cards from Jamaco, but each deck was pre-shuffled in exactly the same way, so the results of the current shoe were exactly the same as the results of the last shoe. Players notice this pattern, and because superstitious baccarat players often track who wins the hands, and started betting table max, which was $5,000 per spot. 41 hands later, the casino was down $1.5 million, and they stopped the game for some reason. In one lawsuit, the court ruled the house didn't have to pay the players. The second case, the same judge ruled the other way. Now it's been appealed, which came down last week, and a superior court judge ruled that the game was void because one of the conditions of play is that shuffled cards are used and these cards aren't shuffled, and the players knew it. So the players have to return the $1.5 million in chips and cash. Never mind, some of the cash has undoubtedly been spent since 2012. Presumably the case will be appealed again. Personal thought, this is outrageous. Players sat down and risked their money on a game provided by the casino. Unlike the Phil Ivey case, the players did nothing to induce the casinos to make this mistake. It's not a requirement that the players know the exact rules of a game to play, nor to make sure the casino follows every one of those rules. Much of what the casino does is hidden from the players anyway. So how can a player be responsible for things they don't even have to know about, and even if they did know about it, can't verify? This court ruling should be overturned. So much of the principles we live by as APs is that the casinos, when they make a mistake, it's fair game to take advantage of that mistake. Do you have any thoughts on that, Richard?
It's just mind-bogglingly stupid to me. It's just as incredibly bad a ruling as the Phil Ivey case in London. And what the judge said is not true, that the cards were not shuffled. I mean, my understanding is the cards were not in a ace, two, three, four order. So they were not unshuffled completely, but as it turned out, they were not shuffled randomly. It's just ridiculous. It reminds me of the old days when the casinos ran the state of Nevada and could basically, you know, do these kind of things in the courts. But I don't think this was a case of a judge being corrupt. I just think it was a case of him being stupid and not understanding gambling.
Well, we'll see. We'll be talking to Bob Nersessian hopefully in a few weeks. And we talked to him about this case last time he was on. We'll probably talk to him about it again.
Yeah, I'm sure he'll get fired up and start banging the table. We'll have to start telling him, Don't hit the table, Bob.
Yeah, he bounces off the ceiling when he's in the studio. All right. Last week on the show, we were talking about different sorts of APs arising because different kinds of gambling games will be offered in the future. In New Jersey, they're now allowing games of physical skill in a casino. And on March 21st, the Borgata is offering a free throw contest. You need to be 21 years of age or older and a member of the Borgata Players Club. But it's okay if you're a member of the New York Knicks, Philadelphia 76ers, or any other professional team that has a day off. You have to pony up $20 to enter, And first prize is only $5,000. So it's hard to imagine pros being interested. But college basketball players, most of their seasons will be off by then. That'll be in the middle of tournament sessions, but most teams in the country aren't going to be in the tournaments. And I'm sure there's a bunch of 21-year-old college basketball players who think that a $5,000 prize is worth shooting for. Pun intentional. Now, is shooting free throws one of your many specialties, Richard?
Well, you know, because I'm close to 7 feet, us big men have a trouble, you know, because the arc of the ball, we always have trouble with free throws. But, you know, I have a friend who's an advantage player who in seventh or eighth grade, their school was having some free throw shooting contests. So he was not a basketball player at all, but he went out and practiced for hours and hours and hours to win that contest. So I'm sure there's some guy out there right now in New Jersey practicing his free throws to go get into that tournament.
Well, I'm sure, but these players on a team have been shooting 1,000 free throws a week for months, and just as part of their regular practice to be on the team. And so somebody who's going to take it up and they only have a month to practice.
Actually, you know, my son played a lot of basketball all the way from like fourth grade through high school. And he went to a basketball camp, I remember, and they brought in a free throw guy. And the guy was talking to the kids and shooting free throws the whole time and basically shot 200 free throws in a row while he was giving his talk on how to shoot free throws.
Wow.
So maybe he'll fly out there. I don't know if $5,000 is worth it to, you know, fly to Atlantic City, but
I don't know. All right. Now, we received an email addressed to gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com that referenced an article I posted on my weekly blog saying that when I'm out of town, maybe on a cruise or something, that sometimes I've had friends pick up my free play in a casino. So the email referenced a man named J. Antonio Cifazzari, who was sentenced to a year in jail for collecting the free play off a number of players' cards at Foxwoods. The question was, wasn't I condoning the same thing that this guy was sent to jail for? My answer is that I was suggesting something very different. According to the court document, Cifazzari would find the players' cards on the floor, search Facebook for clues on the player's PIN number, such as the year of the player's birth or the last four digits of his Social Security number, or sometimes a simple pattern like 1, 2, 3, 4, and steal the free play off the card. He and his cohorts did this off of about 100 different players, and presumably they tried it on several others but couldn't figure out the PIN. If the accusations are correct, Cifazzari deserves to be in jail for this. I see no similarity between what he's accused of and a friend picking up free play at my request. Now, it should give you pause about always using the same PIN, especially if that PIN can be connected to you on social media. And if several people know your PIN, perhaps because you've had them pick up free play for you in the past, it's probably time to change your PIN. It also makes me wonder if the guy was really doing time for what his crime is, or if he shut up and took the fall without explaining. If you find a player's card on the floor, it's tough to figure out a PIN number, even looking at Facebook. A card might say John Lopez. Well, there are hundreds or thousands of John Lopez's out there. There are lots of possibilities, and most casinos lock up after three or four bad guesses on a PIN number. It sounds much more likely that this guy had some inside help from somebody in the Players Club or surveillance. Richard, if we search your Facebook account, will we find your PIN number?
No. I mean, first of all, anybody who doesn't have their privacy settings on Facebook, I mean, set to... You know, I mean, you shouldn't be able to see anything, you know, on somebody's Facebook account. And I don't put my real birth date on my Facebook account. I mean, you know, I would certainly try if the guy's birthday is, you know, June 17th, 0617 would be my first guess, you know. And I think
1, 2, 3, 4 would be your second.
1, 2, 3, 4 would be my second. Yeah. I mean, I was sort of actually showed some ingenuity to come up with this scam. I'm surprised he supposedly got away with $90,000.
I mean, there's a couple of them, but he was the mastermind.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. But actually, you said earlier before the show that You thought that there was a strong possibility that you may have had inside help from someone working in the Players Club, which...
That's a guess. I did not heard of this case until I got the email this week. I have absolutely no inside knowledge about it.
But it wouldn't be the first time that, you know, somebody working inside a Players Club has been helping somebody rip off...
It seems so far-fetched that they could figure that out. And they'd have to know when their free play was going to be on their card. And different players get free plays at different times. So possibly Foxwoods, everybody gets it on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, and they can just, and it's a pattern like that. But mostly out-of-towners get it different than locals, and some players get it different than other players simply because the casino wants to space out the play during the week. And when you see a card down there, often... You don't know if it's going to be getting $5 a free play or $500. Now, there are tier levels at some casinos, but you don't want to go through all this effort and just get $5 for it.
Yeah.
And so, anyway, let's talk to our guest. Tyson Stribe is an author and a key contributor to the last three poker books in the Kill Phil series, namely Kill Everyone, The Razor's Edge, and Flop, Turn, and River. He's been studying and modeling poker for about 15 years and specializes in game theory and equilibrium solution. He also has experience with artificial intelligence and creates computer players for a wide variety of card and board games. Tyson Stribe, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Thank you very much for having me.
Tyson, we want to get into poker, but I just have to ask you, what does that mean you create computer players for board games?
So if you get a board game on, like, say, your iPad or something like that, a lot of times they'll have computer players that you can practice against. So I will make the strategies and rules for those kinds of players that you can play against for different board games.
So bots.
So you work for the companies that create the games?
Yes.
Oh, you know what? You should work on the Hearts game on Windows machines. They're terrible Hearts players.
Yeah, they are.
Now, how did you get started writing about poker?
Well, I started studying poker basically on my own right as the poker boom was just getting started. I was mostly a single table, sit and go player online, and I just kept seeing that there were certain situations that you saw over and over again, a lot of endgame situations, like, you know, when should you push with a small stack? And I knew that there had to be a way that you could work it out and solve those kinds of situations perfectly. Started working on my own, come up with some equilibrium solutions before anybody had ever published anything like this. In the past, whenever anybody talked about, game theory or equilibrium for poker, it was always these little toy games that really had no relationship to real poker at all. At the time, I was also a big reader of 2+2, and they were just starting putting out their online magazine. And there was this general call for articles. And so I was saying, I've got these couple ideas. Maybe I could get something to work out. So put some ideas together, submitted it. The editor at the time was Ed Miller. And he read the submission that I had and said, hey, this is great stuff. You know, you like to write another article? So, next month I wrote another article as well. And after the second month, he's like, wow, this is great. Would you like a monthly spot? So I did that for a while, writing monthly articles for 2+2 magazine. And then Lee Nelson, who wrote Kill Phil, saw one of my articles on the magazine and was saying, hey, this is exactly the kind of stuff that I'm looking for. I'm looking to... write another book. Would you like to write a chapter or two in my new book? And then, started working with him, wrote, a chapter or two, and same thing. He's like, oh, this is great. Let's do more. and a chapter or two ended up, you know, probably being about 60% of the book.
So this is the let me ask the other question first. There's thousands of poker books out there on the market, many thousands. How is the current book, Flop Turn River, different from the others, and what is your target audience?
Well, Flop Turn River is basically at its heart, it's a workbook. You know, it's a series of hands that we present you, where we present a situation to the reader. We tell you what kind of a tournament you're playing in, what you've learned about your opponent so far, what the action has been, what the chip counts of everybody around the table is, and of course your cards, basically giving you all the details you need to make an informed decision. We stop to ask the reader at different points what they would do in a particular situation. And the reader can basically make up their own mind, you know, in this situation I would fold or I would raise or whatever. Then, you know, basically turn the page and we tell the reader what we would do and the reasons why we think a certain action, is the right action. We also have a couple of a little mini lessons thrown throughout the book. We use lots of the problems to highlight those lessons and so forth.
So we should tell our audience. So the book is geared specifically to No Limit Hold'em tournament play.
Right. So this is No Limit Hold'em. It's essentially just for tournaments. You could use some of the advice we give you for a cash game as well, especially the deep stack advice that we give. But a lot of the book is also on, you know, shorter stack work, pushing the bubble and things like that. You had also asked about the target audience. This book is more of a beginner's book. It's for people essentially in the beginner to intermediate range. And that's taken a couple of people by surprise because our first two books before this were quite advanced. So Kill Everyone and Razor's Edge had some really heavy, meaty stuff in it, and a lot of advanced concepts. A couple of people, you know, bought this book early, Flop Turn River, and were kind of surprised. We intended this to be for more of people in the beginner to intermediate range, you know, for a player who's just starting to get comfortable with his game.
And what do you think the biggest mistakes that those players, the beginner to intermediate players, what are the biggest mistakes they're making?
Either playing too many hands or not playing enough hands. You know, it depends on what they've seen on TV and if they try to copy it or not. Sometimes you see the big bluffs that they run on TV, and a guy thinks, oh yeah, I can do that too, and then he doesn't have the skills to follow it up, and it ends up getting lost or losing his entire stack.
Now, so even though it's a beginner book, it seems like you need to know something. There were cases where you asked the players what they would do, and depending on a few thousand dollars a stack, they would either raise all in or call or fold with the exact same position, but just relatively small changes in their stack size compared to the number of big blinds. Now that's not that doesn't strike me as a beginner concept. They got to know something before they can have a chance to get that. Is that true?
Yeah, it's not for absolute beginners. We assume the reader, you know, knows the basics and knows some stuff. They know, they know their way around the poker table at least a little bit, because we didn't want to spend too much time on the absolute basics. But, you know, besides the fact that you occasionally do have to take risks, such as making big moves and big all-ins, you know, we're not assuming that the reader knows all that much.
How much poker do you play? I mean, are you like a full-time player or?
I'm not a full-time player. I'm a casual player. I used to play a lot more than I do. I was a big online player until Black Friday happened, and then basically, you know, quit the online scene. I do play occasionally live, but definitely not as much as I used to.
And do you play primarily tournaments, or do you also play cash games?
I play both. I prefer tournaments, but a lot of times you just can't find a tournament live, so you end up playing cash games.
Do you come for the World Series?
I try to. I don't make it every year, but I've played a couple of times.
You have five different authors listed in this book, including yourself and Lee Nelson, who you've already talked about, but Tony Dunst, Dennis Waterman, and World Series of Poker main event champion Joe Hushom. How does it make it more valuable to the reader than, say, just one by you personally? And, yeah, answer that first, and then I have a follow-up.
I think one of the main advantages is that you get to see lots of different viewpoints. A lot of times we wouldn't agree on what to do with a certain hand. We talked as we were writing the book, we talked about the different hands. Sometimes we were able to convince each other that a certain strategy was better than others, and other times, you know, we still maintained our differences. And in those cases, there's actually a couple problems in the book where we say, hey, you know, the authors, you know, didn't really agree on what the right answer was. These guys say you should do this. Those guys over here say you should do that. And here's the reasons that both camps gave. And a lot of times the reader can see, you know, what's going on both sides. They can basically understand that situation and make up their own mind.
That's, to me, that's one of the things that makes poker so difficult is, you know, coming from a blackjack background, there's a correct play and a wrong play. You know what play is. It's black and white. So, you know, that's poker's a difficult game. But how is it writing with four other guys? I mean, how does that work?
I should probably give you a little bit of a background about how the book came together. It's kind of an odd story. We originally were going to do a series of seminars. You know, a lot of the poker tours have these seminars attached to them where you can sign up and get lessons from pros and stuff like that. The World Series has one, and all the other poker tours have one. So the Asia Pacific Poker Tour was just starting, and we were able to catch the gig of basically being the seminar attached to the Asia Pacific. And Lee Nelson kind of rounded up some people he had worked with before, which was basically all five of us. And we decided to put together, you know, some lesson plans and works to give at this seminar. And we had put together sort of a rough draft of this workbook as part of what we gave the people who went to the seminar. The seminars we only ended up doing two of the seminars, and after that it kind of got scrubbed. But we retained the workbook. We brushed it up even more, added some more examples. You know, made it crisper, made some nice table graphics to go with it. And turned it into this book.
Now, early in the book, you start off talking about the rule of 5 and 10, which you credit to a book by Stuart Rubin and Bob Schifioni. What is the rule? And in a typical tournament, how often should a player use that rule?
So the rule of 5 and 10 basically is... it's a rule to help you determine whether or not you should call, you know, basically a raise with preflop with a speculative hand. And a speculative hand being like a small pocket pair or a suited connector or semi-connector, meaning, you know, maybe 8-6 suited or something like that. And so the rule of 5 and 10, basically you're looking at what percentage of your stack does this raise represent. So you look at the size of the raise, you look at your own stack. If the raise is less than 5% of your stack, then it's a no-brainer call. You can easily call. If it's more than 10%, then you should not call. You might re-raise with it, but you shouldn't flat call when it's more than 10% of your stack. If it's between 5 and 10%, then you basically have a judgment call. Based on what you know of the other players, what your table position is, you know, are you in position behind the raiser or not? Is it a good pocket pair? Is it pocket deuces? You know, so it's you basically have some judgment call in between 5 and 10. But that's what the rule basically says is under 5, you know, easy call. Over 10, you don't call, and in between, it's your choice.
Do most tournament players today seem to be using some variation of this rule, or is this?
I think a lot of the good players do. There are definitely a lot of people who don't. You see people who flat call with half their stack all the time, and then end up folding later, which seems absolutely ridiculous to me. It depends. There's a wide variety of people out there, so it's really tough to say, you know, if a lot of people do or don't. It's gotten, you know, a little bit of publicity, you know, in the original book by Ruben, and also by our books. We're big proponents of 5 and 10.
In the mid tournament section of the book, one of the concepts is the small 3-bet. Which apparently is a style of poker currently in vogue, but it wasn't in vogue several years ago. Tell us about this.
Okay, so a 3-bet, that's basically another word for a re-raise. And in this case, we're talking about 3-bets before the flop. So somebody else makes a raise, which is a 2-bet, and your re-raise, which is the 3-bet. So, you know, tournament poker has become much more aggressive in recent years. And since people are raising pre-flop with a wide variety of weaker hands, it makes sense that you should be re-raising those players that do that a lot more often, especially in position. So the reason why you would do it and the advantages of 3-betting are basically the same advantages of, you know, basically raising in the first place. Mainly that you take control of the action right there. You might win the pot, you know, there and then, or maybe he calls, you see a flop. Most likely he's going to check to you, and you get to play the hand in position. So you can either make a continuation bet or just check through after he checks to you. So, you know, that's basically why you would want to use it. We advocate more on the small side of 3-bets just so that you can do it more often without risking too much of your stack. So usually we're advocating something in the range of re-raising like 2.5 to 3 times his bet size, maybe a little bit bigger than that if the stacks are pretty deep. If the stacks are smaller, you know, you're going to be trying to re-raise on the smaller end, unless that small bet is big enough that, you know, you basically might as well go all in. And that actually kind of ties neatly into the rule of 5 and 10. If his raise is more than 10% of your stack, you know you're not going to be calling. So it's either re-raise or fold. And if you're looking for something like 2.5 to 3 times his bet size, you're looking at putting in something close to 30% of your own stack, which doesn't really make sense without going all in anyway, because you basically won't have much fold equity after that. So you're kind of looking at, you know, maybe going all in right away if his bet is more than 10% of your stack.
But there's this move now with these small raises, right? I mean, back a few years ago, it seemed like 3 times the big blind was the standard raise, but that's gotten smaller and smaller.
Yeah.
And doesn't that kind of price people in, or why has it gotten so small?
I think it's gotten so small because people love to raise, and because it's fun. And when you're raising, you know, and you can make it cheaper, then you can afford to do it more. I think it got smaller and smaller because people were not adjusting on the other side. People weren't calling those smaller bets more often, especially when they really should. They were still folding their big blind, even though the guy was only raising two times the big blind. It only cost one more, but they were giving up their blind. So people saw that they were able to steal the blinds with a much smaller raise. And over the years, you could sort of see that evolution. I think it's beginning to kind of come back, and that people are defending their blinds a little bit more vigorously now. So it's becoming not quite as effective. So for me, I don't go for the really small raises unless I think I can get away with it. If I think my opponents, you know, are going to defend their blinds, just because everybody else is raising two times, you know, I won't necessarily do that. I might stick with, you know, a three times the big blind raise if I think people are going to be calling. It really depends on how my table is playing. If they're really loose, then I'm upping my raise size. If they're tight and throwing everything away, then I'll go ahead and stick with the tiny raises and steal for cheap.
The bubble is a term meaning anybody who's still in after the bubble gets some money, and anybody who goes out before that doesn't. So when you get near the bubble, how should your strategy change?
So this is something that we talk through extensively in Kill Everyone. We touch on it a little bit in Flop Turn River as well. We've got a whole chapter about how you should play near the bubble. And your strategy needs to change quite a bit for playing on the bubble. And there's lots of reasons for it, and I could spend an hour talking about it, but
how about 6 minutes?
Yeah. You know, basically, how you play really depends on how your stack size is compared to everybody else. And when you're a big stack, it's time to play the bully, basically, when you're on the bubble, because you're not afraid of busting out and missing the money, and everybody else is. So they're playing scared, so you should be, you know, you should be raising every other hand or more, just to get everybody else to fold, and so you accumulate more and more chips because they're playing scared and you're not. Whereas the tables are kind of flipped when you're one of the small and medium stacks. You got to be a little bit more scared because it can be a decent payday if you make the money, but you don't want to be so timid that either you're just bleeding away chips, or maybe your stack is so tiny that, you know, you can't afford to, you know, sit out another round as the blinds go by.
Is it fair to say there are potentially lots of bubbles in a tournament? For example, on a multi-day tournament, there are some people who really just want to say they made it through day one and still alive. So near the end of day one, even though you're not close to the money, these people start playing timidly, and that would seem like a good place for your strategy. Or another kind of case is the final table bubble, or maybe the TV bubble. Are those legitimate uses of the term, or am I smoking?
No, absolutely. Yeah. There are multiple bubbles in a tournament. It's not just that. And in some cases, the other bubbles may be bigger than the money bubble. The day one bubble can kind of swing both ways. You get people who want to say that they survived day one. You also get people who, you know, it's the last few hands in day one. They've got a tiny stack. They say, I don't want to come back tomorrow with a small stack, you know. So I'm just going to, you know, play big or go home. So it can kind of swing both ways on day one. I've seen both things happen. But the other ones, definitely. People want to make the final table. You know, there's another big prize jump right there. So anytime there's a big prize jump, the bubble table or the bubble factors kick in. And if the final table's televised, you know, hey, you basically view your television exposure as, you know, some amount of EV, just for getting a little publicity there.
So it seems pretty easy to know if you're the big stack to be the big bully, but you know, what do you do with the small stack or the medium stack? I mean, you can't just sit there and play tight, right? I mean,
right. It depends on how much of a risk you can take. If you're a smallish stack, and there's this big stack out there, and he's raising every hand. He's just every single hand he's raising because everybody's folding. If you are fairly small and you've got, you know, if you were to re-raise, you know, basically it would be an all-in re-raise for you. You can use that as a weapon back at him. One of the things about bubble play is it's kind of whoever gets their money all in first wins.
It's like a game of
chicken. Nobody wants to be the caller of an all in. You know, it's a lot safer to push your money all in and hope that everybody else folds, rather than, you know, somebody else pushed all in and you hope you have a good enough cards and you call the all in. That's a lot more dangerous. So if you can fight back and do an all in re-raise over a bully, especially somebody who's raising every single hand, you know that he doesn't have quality hands all the time. Yes, you're taking a risk, but by fighting back, let's say you fight back when you're the big blind. Next time the orbit goes around and you're big blind again, maybe he won't raise. You know, maybe he'll just give you a pass, because especially if everybody else is still being timid, he knows he can steal from everybody else. He doesn't need to steal from you. So if you show that you're kind of willing to stick to your guns and shove it all in there, you know, he might just give you a pass.
So who should you be attacking? Let's say you're in the medium stack. You know, you can't just sit there passively. So who should you be targeting at that point?
Right. So if you're you should be basically targeting anybody who's smaller than you. And if you're the smallest guy at the table, then you gotta pick your place. Unfortunately, it comes down to that. I talk a lot about this in some of my previous books. And in fact, there's this whole mathematical analysis that I do called the bubble factor, which basically quantifies for every player around the table, you know, how worried they should be at the bubble, and against each other player, you know, how strongly, you know, the bubble situation manifests itself. And it turns out a lot of times that a lot of the old adages we hear are true, which is that, you know, people should pick on stacks smaller than themselves. Some people know, but not everybody knows, is that the big stacks should actually be picking on the medium stacks more than the small stacks.
And why is that?
Because the medium stacks have a lot more to lose, and so they should be more scared of you than the small stacks. If you're the big stack, everybody's going to bust if they tangle with you.
Only if
but
they
the
lose.
The medium stacks have more to lose. So if they're smart, they should be more scared of you than the small stacks. The small stacks might say, you know, hey, I'm not going to make it big no matter what. So I'm, you know, I could take a stand, try to double up, maybe become a medium stack myself. So the small stack might, you know, is more likely to fight back.
This is a beginner intermediate workbook, and so your previous two books in the series kind of lay the groundwork for more advanced workbooks. Are there any others in the works, or is this it?
I'll never say this is it. I don't have any plans right now. I have thoughts flowing through my head, but they've been there for a while and haven't turned into enough of something for me to come up with an entirely new book. I'm still working on it. I've got a couple of ideas around other kinds of equilibrium plays and stuff like that that haven't been dealt with in the literature so far, and some more analysis of, you know, bubbles in large fields and stuff like that.
Do you do any other advantage gambling besides poker?
Not really. I don't live in Vegas. I don't live near a casino. So I don't get that many opportunities for advantage play. But I would, you know, I would if I had the opportunity. That's the kind of person I am. I used to play blackjack before poker got big. But once poker took off, I kind of switched horses, as it were.
Now, your book, we have about 4 minutes left for the interview section. Your book concludes with final table play and eventually heads up play. So how are those different from the play in the earlier parts of the book?
The things that we mainly highlight in the final table play and the heads up is mostly dealing with shorthanded play. So the rest of the book was always focused on a full table. So you got 9 or 10 people at the table. But as you're going through the final table and people are dropping out, you got to deal with, well, how do you play when it's only 5-handed? How do you play when it's 4-handed? And what kind of changes should you be making in those kinds of cases? And then finally, when it gets to heads up, you know, you're going to be making the biggest changes of all, because you're basically going to be playing almost every single hand. So there, you got some big adjustments. You can't just keep playing the same way no matter how many people are at the table.
Now the World Series is going to be starting in a few months. And last year, and probably in coming years, they've had a lot of events such as six-handed tables. So the tables are always six-handed or less. So I don't know how much the literature has been created to deal with that specifically, but that sounds like a problem that's well-suited to your abilities to address. Have you considered that particular problem?
I have considered it. And that may be something that I, you know, would write about some more. I do know that there are a couple books out there. I can't remember the names off the top of my head, that do deal with six max play. So some literature is out there, not a lot, but there is some literature out there. It could probably use some more attention on it.
Very good. We've been talking to Tyson Strybe, one of the co-authors of Flop Turn River, the fourth book in the Kill Phil series from Huntington Press. Thank you very much, Tyson. We appreciated you taking time to talk with us.
Thank you.
So did we learn anything, Munchkin?
You know, I like the book. I like those kind of books. You know, I used to, you know, there were backgammon books like that, chess books like that. So I like that sort of workbook format. So it kind of reminded me of the Dan Harrington books. But yeah, so I thought it was worth reading. I thought it was good.
Yeah, it was actually beyond my level. I haven't read a whole lot in poker, and so some of the things they said is, yeah, you should know with this many blinds, you should blah blah blah. And I'm going, guess I don't know that. So, but good, it was useful. If I keep doing this radio show long enough, pretty soon I'll be able to hold my own in a 1-2 game, I guess.
Right.
All right.
Which I have to have one of those one of these days. So
a 1-2 game?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
A home game.
Well, I'm sure I'm always invited because I'm the pigeon. But my secret strategy is let them drink, and then I have then that evens it out a little bit. All right. South Point has more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%. This is more than anyone else has. The main promotion in the month of February is on penny slots. It's called Penny Perks. There are a lot of must-hit-buy penny machines at the South Point. So those of you who play those, whatever your normal strike number is, should go down during the promotion. Next week's class at noon, Wednesday at the Grandview Lounge, will be double-double bonus quick quads. This is a game that returns 99.65% with a 0.30 slot club plus mailers. It's basically an even game 24/7. On two times point days, which happen about once a month, it was have earlier this week. I haven't seen the March mailer yet. It very possibly will be on St. Patrick's Day. Doesn't have to be. It gives the players a nice advantage. Of the games I play, quick quads is the most fun. Now, fun is not usually a big factor in my decisions. I value dollars per hour EV more, but fun is a factor. When there's similar EVs, President's Day, there were other games around town with similar dollar per hour EV, and I chose to play quick quads because that's more fun. Are results oriented? Maybe I should have picked one of the other games. Oh well, at the Pumps, every Friday night, 7 p.m., they have drawings where winners share $10,000. You don't need to be there to win, but you do need to claim your prize by midnight. There's five times entries, Friday 7:45 to midnight, and they also two times entries also on Friday 4:00 to 6:30 in the afternoon. Play for prizes ending February 27th are up to $190 in gift cards, and these are whatever gift cards they have in the warehouse. And they can vary every day. It could be Lowe's, it could be CVS, it could be Albertsons, it could be Einstein Bagels. There's a number of cards which they have issued through the years, and so these are the leftover cards, which are most of them, Chevron would be on that list. Most of them do not expire, so the fact that they've been in the warehouse isn't a factor. Gift cards may be earned and redeemed Monday through Friday at a rate of 0.20%. You keep your points. In some respects, this is equivalent to double points. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play a lot of games. If you sign up for the Gold membership, which is $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, it allows you to get corrections on most of the games, including quick quads. It's a good place to practice quick quads. You can get the strategy from Shaq's website or mine, but if you want correction, go to videopoker.com. For most players, you have no idea of how bad you really play until you've had a computer program correcting your plays. The game of the week at the contest of the week at the videopoker.com is Ultimate X. This is a 10-coin per line game where you win bonuses for the next hand whenever you get at least your money back on any line this hand. It's a very volatile game, but one that's very popular. On the Wizard of Oz website, there are reasonable strategies for several of the best games. Our guest the next 2 weeks, I'm going to talk about the first one, and I'm going to let Munchkin talk about the second. Michael Gaughan will be our guest next Thursday night. He is the owner of the South Point, and we're going to be talking about his father, Jackie Gaughan, who passed away almost a year ago. Jackie is best known for owning the El Cortez in downtown Las Vegas, but he actually had like 25% of all the casino properties under his control at one point. So he is one of the movers and shakers of Las Vegas in the previous generation. The following week is a man named Michael Craig, who wrote a book called The Professor, the Banker, and the Suicide King. Munchkin, what can you tell us about that?
Well, not much other than, he wrote that book, which is really entertaining. I highly recommend it to everyone. He's currently writing for Poker Stars, I believe. He also, he does some magazine writing as well. I just read a really interesting kind of long article that he wrote about Bitcoins. So, that's one of the things I want to ask him about when he's here is sort of cryptocurrencies and the future of gaming and online gaming. So that'll be one of the things I want to talk to him about when he's here.
As far as you know, is that article available online?
Yeah. Yeah. If you just search Michael Craig Bitcoins, it'll pop right up.
Good. Sounds like I have some extra reading to do before that show.
Yeah, he doesn't talk really about using them for online gaming, but we'll talk to him about that, see what he thinks.
Yeah, the book itself is really entertaining. It's about some poker games between this very rich banker from Texas named Andy Beal, who came and played the best poker players in Las Vegas, heads up, for nosebleed stakes.
He decided the only advantage he had was he had such a huge bankroll that he could try to put money pressure on them. And he's been here several times. In fact, he was just here within the last few months playing again, taking another shot at it. I guess he played Todd Brunson. They had a $10 million freeze out. I mean,
$10 million or $1
million? $10 million. They each put up $5
million. Ooh.
And and I guess Todd ended up with all five of his money. So, anyway, it's like I said, the book is really entertaining. I highly recommend it.
Yeah, winning $5 million would be a better than average week for me, that's for sure.
Yeah, it takes me a couple of months to earn that kind of money.
Yeah, in your dreams. All right. So if people want to hear about some of our old shows, how do they do that?
So first of all, we welcome your input, your questions. You can email us at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com, or you can send them to put them on our Facebook page at Facebook/gamblingwithanedge. You can reach me at Twitter at RWM21. And you can sign up to get the show delivered to you automatically at iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, or at my site. To hear an archive of all the past shows, you can get those at bobdancer.com.
All right. Very good. So, and we're going to have to get Bob Nersessian on soon.
Yeah. There's things in the news we want to talk to him about. So.
All right. So right now we're in a stall.
What else? I don't know.
We actually have another surveillance guy that we're working on to get. He's got to pass it through his
the PR firm,
the PR department of his thing, so he'll probably be on soon. So thank you, Richard. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good night.
Good night.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Subscribe to the show in iTunes, and episodes will be delivered to you automatically every week. Archived versions of past shows may be found at bobdancer.com and richardmunchkin.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin are both available on Facebook and welcome your questions. The sponsors for the show are the South Point Hotel, Casino, and Spa, the M Resort, the Palms Casino Resort, and the website videopoker.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.